Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch for each week. Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property finance and money management. Hello, mate.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Very well. We've got a very exciting guest today.
We do.
But before we get there, my mindset minute today is segueing into our very special guest.
Okay.
So, you know that I use Blinkist, which is the the book summary app.
I do.
There's a book, Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Halliday. Have you come across that?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't.
So he says, ego is the desire to gain recognition without working for it, right?
Right.
So an unchecked ego can end up being detrimental to your success, and you should take careful steps to ensure that it doesn't get out of control. So he says, rein in your ego by reminding yourself that there's always more to learn. And so that's our segue into our guest today, because Alan Kohler is a name that's synonymous for anyone who's actually flown on a Qantas plane.
Yes.
Tuned into Channel 2 and listened to...
ABC News.
Q Radio, talking business with Alan Kohler. He's on ABC News, the 7pm report.
And Business Insider for a while there.
Mate, I'm going to rattle it off. You get ready for it. Take a seat. There's a fair bit going on here. But first of all, welcome, Alan.
Yeah. Thanks, Bryce. G'day, Ben.
G'day. Now, Alan's a very successful Australian financial journalist and newspaper editor. Listen,
he is. Ben.
He began as a cadet on The Australian in 1969. He's been a columnist. Columnist for The Australian Financial Review. He was the editor of The Australian Financial Review between 1985 and 1988. He's the editor of The Age, Melbourne newspaper, from 1992 to 1995. He was the CEO of the Australian Independent Business Media, which published the online investment report, the Eureka Report, since 2007 and sold that to News Corp in 2012. As I said, he's the ABC News finance reporter. You can see him at 7pm.
Yep.
Was the host of ABC's Inside Business for 12 years, from 2002. To 2014, does that sound right?
Sounds right.
As I said, the host of Talking Business on Q Radio, also is co-host of the Money Cafe podcast, Ben, which is a very good podcast.
Very good. We'll talk about that.
And more recently, involved
new business?
Building a new business, Constant Investor. You are a very busy man. That's an impressive CV.
Oh, well, you do one thing at a time.
I've often wondered for people like yourself, where you've just interviewed so many people and you've got to provide so much content from a financial capacity. How do you absorb the amount of content that you need to be able to be relevant and give that up-to-date information that you do? Because it's enormous.
I do a lot of reading. A lot of reading, I guess. That's the main thing.
Mm-hmm. And from that reading, you obviously have to form opinions. I mean, ultimately, you know, you're as a journalist, you're doing facts, but also these days, there's also a lot of opinion work that sort of comes out. I mean, the Money Cafe, there's a lot of opinions going on between you and James in regards to what you're seeing in the marketplace. So how do you come to those sort of conclusions and insights? I mean, you've got a wealth of knowledge with a wealth of experience.
Yeah, look, it's, I guess, been around a long time.
Yep.
But look, I started having to have opinions 1979, when I became the Chanticleer columnist.
Yes.
And started writing. So I was 1979, I was 28. I'm a kid, right? I mean, I didn't know anything.
Yes.
Well, I thought I knew everything, but...
There you go, is the enemy.
No, but I suppose the thing that I've always done, and I learnt then, was to draw the distinction between opinion and analysis. So the way I did Chanticleer, I mean, I had to work out how to do it. So my day of Chanticleer, which is a daily column of three or four items of analysis and opinion on the back page of the Financial Review, for those who...
No,
it's still there. It was started in 1974 by Bob Gottliebson. He hired me in 79 to, in a sense, to understudy him and then to replace him because he knew he was going to move on. And so I did that. I did. I spent a year working with Bob and then I took it over myself and did it for 4 years myself. So my day of writing Chanticleer was a 10-hour day. I spent 8 hours on the phone and 2 hours writing.
Wow.
Mm. That was the typical day. I got in the morning at 10 o'clock. And I absolutely just spent 8 hours on the phone talking to people.
Mm. Just
and the way I arrived at the analysis and the opinions that I then had to spew out of me in the 2 hours that I wrote was from talking to people.
Yeah, so you spent basically your life talking to people, haven't you?
Yeah, that's... and in fact, I said before that, you know, mostly where I get this stuff from is reading. It's actually mostly talking to people,
yep.
to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Back when you were 28, you probably didn't have everyone on speed dial like you do now. How was that sort of opening the doors to get those people to converse with you during those 8 hours?
Well, people would tend to talk to the Sean Lick, the Economist, because people tend to talk to the person that they read, you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
You probably are the same, but... And I did spend the first years of my sort of life and being a financial journalist building a contact database. So I went around and it wasn't just people that I knew. I'd sort of harvest names and expertise, and I built an Excel spreadsheet of about 2,000 or 3,000 names.
Wow.
And in the spreadsheet, I had each person's name and their contact details plus their expertise.
Yeah.
And so I was able to filter my database according. So if I needed to do something on banking, I'd filter it by banking and I'd end up with a dozen people I could talk to. And I'd go through that list of people that I could talk to on the subject of banking until I got someone who would talk to me. And so it was a pretty sophisticated, operation.
It was an operation that I actually,
you know, set up, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
Yeah. So take us back pre getting that gig as a cadet back in 1969. What led you down the path of financial journalism?
I was at school at Huntingdale High School, Melbourne suburbs. The only subject I was any good at was English.
Mm-hmm.
I was terrible at everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I did really well in English. And I kind of failed everything else, to be honest.
See, there's endeavour. There's a bit about, you know.
So I kind of...
academically,
I liked I liked writing. I write poetry. I enjoyed English in general. Did a lot of reading. I read voraciously, which led to me being interested in English, and so that's what I was good at. And so I thought I'd better be a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that when I left school at 18, I tried to be a journalist. There was no jobs going. I ended up selling steel pipes for Stewart's and Lloyd's, which was a forerunner to...
A steel fabricator.
Tube makers.
Oh,
and,
okay.
I did that for a little while, and finally a job came up at The Australian, which happened to be in the finance section. And that was how I...
So there wasn't any curiosity around commerce and all that before that time?
No.
No. Just...
I wanted to be a journalist. Yep. The job was in finance section. That's where I was.
Mm. Fantastic.
What was the appeal of journalism back then? What was the allure?
Oh, just the ability to... do what I love doing. I thought then and still think that you're going to be more successful doing something you love.
Yeah.
So I liked writing, so I thought that's what I should do.
Mm-hmm. So inside business, 12 years, what does that look like behind the scenes for our listeners? I mean, it was an hour of television on a Sunday morning, is that right?
Half an hour.
So in terms of prep for that, was there a team of researchers that helped you, or was it a lot of primarily stuff that you had to... research in the lead up to that? What did that look like?
Okay, well, we're jumping forward there, but it was a show that had a team on it. There was an executive producer, assistant producer, a reporter. I'm just trying to think. Cameraman. There was a half a dozen people on the show. They were full time. I kind of was doing other things. I swanned in on Friday to record it. Generally, I'd possibly done an interview during the week, and we put the show together on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly as live, and there were kind of various elements to it that we sort of brought together.
Mm. The same with the on-live subscription business, which is, so I was a subscriber to Business Spectator, and obviously a lot of the people and some of our clients here were also subscribers to the Eureka Report. So obviously a very successful business, you saw things changing in the journalism space and less people going to broadsheet down to obviously reading their content online. So how did that sort of come about? I mean, what was the thought process? Was it because you saw the circulation dropping and there was a potential business opportunity there for you?
Well, 2004, I was a columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age at the time. I was writing on a variety of subjects. You know, it was in a sense a continuation of the Chronicle thing, but it was in The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, which happened to be obviously a slightly different audience to the Financial Review, broader audience.
Yep.
And I started writing about superannuation and self-managed super funds, investing and that sort of thing. And the response I started to get was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I started to campaign. I started to think that financial advisors shouldn't get commissions. In those years, 2003, 2004, obviously the whole financial advice industry was based on getting commissions from fund managers. And I kind of thought that was outrageous. And the reason I thought it was outrageous is because people didn't realise that they were dealing with a salesman.
Mm.
they thought that they were dealing with an advisor who wasn't selling them something. Yes. So there was this kind of gap between what the clients, what the ordinary people thought they were getting and what was actually going on. And so I started to, through the comms of the paper, started to campaign against commissions, saying they should be banned. Obviously, the financial advisors, financial planning industry hated me, and you know, but I thought, well, and I actually thought, well, rather than just say it's bad, I should come up with an alternative. And so I decided to launch the Eureka Report as a sort of an independent advice vehicle for people to do it themselves. People who are, because I was conscious also that there were an increasing number of people who were opting out of the advisory industry in order to do it themselves because of their distaste or dissatisfaction with what was going on. So I came up with Eureka Report as a means of kind of providing them with something that gave them a sort of a macro stream of advice in general about markets. So that was 2005. We launched Eureka Report. That went quite well. You know, a couple of years later, was making money, and then we decided to take on the Financial Review with Business Spectator.
The old boss.
Well, because, you know, the Financial Review at that time was a subscription product only. Yeah. It was tight paywall. $1,100 a year subscription at the time. Very high price. And I thought, well, there's got to be an opportunity to come at them with a free product. Because at that time, you know, 2007, when we launched Business Spectator, online ads were pretty lucrative. They were still, you know, they were still paying okay. So I developed a business plan that made it look like Business Spectator would work as a free product. Using advertising,
ad revenues.
And off we went, right? And because it was the GFC, 2007, it's kind of the GFC began, took a year to lead to the Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008. You know, I was getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning and writing for Business Spectator and publishing at 7 o'clock what had happened overnight on Wall Street, right? So me and Gottliebson and Bartholomew's, who were behind the Business Spectator, we were kind of almost working all night at that time. 2008 was so exciting because every night something was going on, you know. If it wasn't Bear Stearns going broke, it was, you know, it was Lehman Brothers and what the hell's going on with AIG and the Fed Reserve and so on. And so we got real traction. You know, because we were publishing in the morning and the Financial Review came out in the morning with yesterday's news, right? So our slogan was, why pay for yesterday's news?
Great.
And we did well, right? But Business Spectator never made any money because the online advertising market collapsed because of Facebook and Google.
But you did obviously build a significant database of...
So we ended up with Eureka Report and Business Spectator. We ended up with a solid business. You know, it was a decent business, and as you say, we sold it to News Corp in 2012. We didn't really build it to sell, but we got approached
with a price that was too good to refuse, I would have thought.
Well, no, it was an auction between Fairfax and News.
So
Fairfax and News were bidding for it.
It's on the public record, isn't it? In terms of how it was 30 million.
30 million. So, you know, they were happy with that.
What does that feel like? I mean, you start this, you know, this online experience, and then with no view to sell it, then all of a sudden you've got two heavyweights fighting out to buy it, and then all of a sudden it's a pretty nice bounty at the end. What does that feel like?
Well, to be honest, it was mixed. I mean, obviously the money was great, but I genuinely hadn't built it to sell. You know, I really saw it as a long-term thing, and you know, like. But the trouble is that I didn't own all of it. I mean, I only owned less than 30%. We had investors, and Bob and Steve owned a bit, and you know, and the investors in particular, which really controlled the business, they wanted to sell. So there was no question about it, and you know, we all got a bit of money, and it was great. And I actually thought, 2012. Bought by News Corp. I thought the rest of my life, my working life, was going to be in News Corp. That's what I mean, I kind of had this thought, and I actually wanted to help News Corp go digital because that's what they bought their business for.
That's right.
The reason they bought it and paid so much for it was because they wanted to help themselves become more digital. And I kind of thought, that's great. I want to be a part of that. They're a big organisation, you know, they're important to the country, and I want to be a part of it and I want to help them do it. And trouble is that the guy who was in charge of buying this, Kim Williams, who was the CEO of News Corp Australia, got fired not long after that. And that was it. So Business Spectator ended up basically being closed down.
Yes.
And Eureka Report got sold.
Yes, just recently.
A year ago.
A year ago, that's right, yeah.
Well, and last year.
So, and significantly less than obviously what the dream was when they acquired it.
Yeah, that's right. So, I tried to buy it back off them.
Oh, well, okay.
And...
do it.
And they didn't want to sell it to me because it was too embarrassing, really. To
yeah. Well, it was like who was it? Packer bought nine.
Packer
of
bomb. Yeah.
So that was the thing, and yeah. they wouldn't sell it to me.
So therefore, it's evolved into the Constant Investor. So what?
No, well, so I had a 4-year earnout. The deal to sell the business in 2012 involved me actually working for them for 4 years.
Yeah.
And as I say, when I started, I intended to not be 4 years, but to just keep going. As time went on and things changed, I thought, well, I will move on. And so basically the week after my 4 years finished, I launched The Constant Investor as a sort of a successor to Eureka Report. And it's a different product. I think it's better. It's got a lot of podcasting in it. I mean, we're doing...
great content.
Audio interviews every day.
Yes.
We're really kind of... I've got a few staff, but the other good thing about Constant Investor is that I own
100%. Yeah. So News Corp's listening.
You've got content management. You've got everything under your umbrella.
Well, I don't need to. I don't have to worry about investors.
Yes.
I don't have to worry about at this stage anyway. Maybe I'll raise some money at some point, but at this stage, I'm happy.
So before we switch gears and talk about property, what does a typical week look like for you? With a whole range of commitments that you do have, I've been in the privileged position to be interviewed by you for Q Radio, so it's nice to be able to be in a position to interview you back. But what does a typical week look like for you trying to fit all these commitments in?
Well, the Q Radio, the Qantas in-flight audio thing, is once a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I spend a day doing just back-to-back interviews, a dozen interviews.
Yeah.
So that's once a month. It's fine.
Do you have to go to Sydney for that, or is it all Melbourne?
No, it's
all
in Melbourne.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
Yeah, but a lot of the interviewees are in Sydney. We're just on the line.
Yeah, okay.
So I enjoy that. It's like speed dating. I get sort of this kind of a dozen.
Yes,
great highlights reel. Yeah.
Really interesting people that I get to talk to once a month. So that's good. As you say, I do the ABC News spot for finance every day, and that involves me going to the ABC studios at about 3:30
in South Bank
for a couple of hours.
Yep.
It takes me a couple of hours to sort of put it together and record it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I write 2 columns a week for The Australian still as part of, when I finished up with them as an employee, I went to being a contractor and I write 2 columns a week, one on Saturday, one on Monday. And apart from that, I have an office in Hawthorne for the Constant Investor where I go to there every day. I've got my staff.
Yes, well, I've There's been five there. Of them. We've You've done a webinar there. And property and a few other things, so it's good stuff.
It's a startup.
It's fun.
It's a small startup office we're having a good time.
The content is really good. I mean, I'm privileged. I'm one of the subscribers, so I get to see, some of the stock picks. I get to see what you're writing about, what you're reading. So that to me is really terrific. And then obviously there's the chat time that they get with you as well. So, if you wanted to broaden your horizons around equities and the market, it's a great place to go.
What is the vision for a Constant Investor subscriber from your perspective? What do you hope that they get out of it?
Well, I just hope that they get some support for their thinking about what to do with their money, how to invest. They're thinking about the principles of investing, but also what's going on in the world. I try to synthesize a lot of the analysis that's going on about what's going on in the world. Like, for example, last night the Federal Reserve announced its latest monetary policy, which is that they're going to sort of start tightening, reverse quantitative easing, and possibly starting to increase interest rates again in December. I did a quick interview this morning with Jeremy Minack, who is a tremendous observer of this stuff, has spent his life doing it. 20 minutes, that goes out later on today, and then I'll kind of look at it in detail on Saturday. So that sort of thing, but also to provide ideas. And one of the things that I think that is lacking is that the top 200 and even 300 stocks are pretty well covered in Australia by the press and the brokers and everything, but there's 2,300 stocks on the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're the ones, in a sense, they're the ones that are going to go up 10 times.
Mm.
They're the ones that are interesting and exciting companies. And just because they're small doesn't make them bad. You know, just because a company's big doesn't make it good. You know, so I'm interested in interviewing them. So yesterday, for example, I interviewed a bloke who runs a business out of Christchurch, which is listed on the ASX, called CropLogic, which is agronomy. You know, they put sensors in the ground and they have drones and aerial imagery to help farmers with science, with technology.
So they can map those sites out. Because obviously the tractors these days run off sort of automatic quadrant mapping, don't they? Like they can self-drive and
things. And so
like
farming is becoming technology-driven.
And tech.
And so they're in that business. And there was another one that does communications for drones. So lots of really interesting businesses. The one with drone communication is based in Tel Aviv, also listed on the ASX.
Okay, yep.
So there's just so many interesting opportunities and companies. So what I do is I'll get a CEO of the company and talk to them for 20 minutes to half an hour, really drill into what's going on with the business.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can use that as a sort of a shortcut research tool.
Yeah, yeah. Because how often do we as punters and shareholders get a chance to talk to the CEO? So we're obviously using you as that intermediary, which is terrific. Fantastic.
From your perspective as a financial commentator, what are your observations on Donald Trump in terms of financial markets around the world? Have you formed a view on what this man's behaviour is likely to have an impact, particularly on Australia, but around the world, given some of his commentary of late?
Oh, look, I think he's becoming increasingly irrelevant, really. And there was obviously a big lift in markets after November last year when he won.
The tax package and everything.
Yeah, there was a lot of optimism. There was a lot of sense that you know, it was going to be great, and the markets went up and all that stuff. But the markets, in particular, interest rates have been coming down ever since. The dollar, US dollar, has been coming down since basically January the 1st. So the dollar, the US dollar, went up when he was elected. But really, from inauguration time, the US dollar has been in decline. The US stock market has been strong.
It has.
But that's not got anything to do with Donald Trump. It's because earnings are strong. Most of the rise in the US stock market has been driven by Facebook, Amazon.
The big five, Google.
The FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix and Google, which have been driving it. And also
FANG
a lot
stocks.
Of...
Yeah, I love that. It's something we could take away. I haven't heard called the FANG stocks, but that's brilliant.
Yeah, the FANGs. It's FAANG. Yes. But it's Silicon Valley in general. So, I mean, really, it's been about the strength of Silicon Valley, America's leadership of the world in technology and artificial intelligence. And that's been driving that. And also the other thing is that bond yields unexpectedly fell this year, which has also adjusted valuations. So equity market valuations are driven off the 10-year bond yield on the whole, and it's unexpectedly fallen because inflation is low. And again, that's got nothing to do with Donald Trump. And so I think that really nobody expects much to happen in relation to his fiscal policies, his tax reform. Maybe he'll get something through, maybe he won't, who knows. But a kind of market's now moved on. And obviously it won't be irrelevant if he causes a nuclear war. That'll be bad. But personally, I don't think that'll happen.
Well, hopefully there'll be smarter people around him who won't allow that to happen.
Hopefully the second person with the codes, but
forgets them. Yeah, exactly.
So do you have a good memory? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you need to retain. How do you... Is that something that you're blessed with?
You're great with names. Like, you can just...
I'm terrible.
Rattle off all of these dates and, like, there's so...
I've got a terrible memory. It's certainly not as good as
I'd like
it to be. I
listen to the Money Cafe and you're like, you and James, and James is like, who's that guy? And you just go, it's Rob, blah.
Well, you're just supposed to have the perform... Like, because I've listened to the Money Cafe as well, and I've obviously observed you in all of the media outreaches you have. There must be something that happens that you just click into gear then.
Oh, well, there is an element of showbiz about it. Yeah, that's true. You know, you're sort of...
You're just comfortable.
I'm very conscious of trying to help the audience, how can I put it? It's not about me. It's about, like, trying to help people understand what they're doing with their investing. It's their money, and it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's terribly confusing. And I happen to have the facility to synthesize and to explain things. So I like doing that, you know.
I think that's the best part. I mean, I look at the graphs on ABC News, and they tell a story, and you tell that story really well in a concise way for your, 45-second slot, effectively. But that's what I get a lot out of. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And I love the way, the graph of the day is this or the graph of the day is that. it just gives you a sense of, if you watch it consistently, you can draw a picture of what's happening around the world.
And we should also tell the listeners that Alan's very humble as well, because as soon as he realised we were going to make this podcast about his background, he started shuffling in the seat, didn't want to talk about himself, which is...
I do prefer to ask questions than answer them, that's true.
So can we just stay on the economy for a bit before we get into property? In terms of the broader economy, so we've dabbled in a little bit of what's going on in the US, and we think the market's pretty reasonable over there, and their recovery, jobs growth is pretty good over there. Last night, Fed Reserve talking about quantitative easing is gone now. They've got all this debt that they've converted into bond. What's the strategy there around trying to sell off that to basically return that money back to basically the government? Is there any sort of thoughts on that?
What they've been doing up to this point, so they've got this $4.5 trillion worth of government bonds that they've bought from the banks in order to push money back into the economy. So they're sitting on this lump of all these bonds. And what they've been doing is, as the bonds mature or pay interest, they reinvest it to maintain the holding. So what they're going to do, from now on, is to not do that. They're not going to roll it over.
Okay. Right.
So it's basically it's kind of a rundown strategy rather than a sale.
Okay.
They're not not roll them over.
Yep.
Not reinvest the interest and so on. So they'll just start to run it down, and it'll run down very gradually. What they've been saying, both Janet Yellen and one of the other Fed governors said recently, that it'll be like watching paint dry.
Very slow.
That's what they say.
Yeah, and they need to do that because they obviously don't want to shake the markets.
Well, they had in 2013, Ben Bernanke, who was then the chairman of the Fed, announced that they're going to start winding back quantitative easing later that year, and that was famously what was called the taper tantrum. So 2013, bond yields spiked upwards, the bond market crashed, and that was kind of really unsettling for all markets. And so they're very concerned now to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Yeah. So the communication, the conversation is steady. Yeah.
So they've been flagging this for so long that everything's well.
What about that interest rate that finally came, that 25 basis points? It was like they flagged it for 18 months. They had a false start. They were trying to do it before because it continued on. And then finally the markets had already priced it in by the time it actually hit.
But it is also true that if quantitative easing and interest rates at zero, roughly, was bullish for the markets, then you would think that quantitative tightening and increasing interest rates is bearish.
Yeah.
And on the whole, that has to be true. So, but the question is how bearish, and really that has to do with whether they go too fast and too hard, whether they accidentally cause a recession is the main thing. Bear markets are caused by recessions, and probably won't be a bear market unless there is a recession in the US.
Yeah.
And will there be one? Well, it depends on what the Fed does, really. I mean, what was interesting last night, I think, was that for the first time, they said we're going to increase interest rates no matter what. Because up till this point, they've been saying that it's all data dependent, as they say. Right? They've been saying that, we'll put up rates as the data informs the policy, tells us what to do.
Yeah.
But now they've kind of basically said they're going up.
Yeah.
And what that means is that, in a sense, they've given up on trying to get inflation up. Because what the data has been kind of on about, really, for the last couple of years, is that the economy's been recovering, the labour market's great, but inflation is not where it ought to be. Inflation is really low, 1.5% or something.
Yes.
And so that's been holding them back from increasing interest rates, because they don't want to, because they want to get inflation back up to 2%.
Yeah, they certainly fear deflation as a...
Well, they just want inflation. Argument. They want inflation up to 2%.
Yeah.
And now they're saying, to paraphrase it, they're saying, forget that. We're looking at the labour market. The labour market's strong. The economy's strong. We're going to put up interest rates, even though inflation is low.
Yep.
And I think that's an interesting change.
So we're coming up to a decade from the event that sort of triggered the GFC. Do you think that the policymakers, the treasuries, the global sort of bankers have done what they've needed to do? I mean, there was a lot of talk about we should let Greece just basically, collapse and we'd be a lot better off because of that. Have you got a view around that this quantitative easing and this printing of money and this sort of stimulus idea where you make obviously debt cheap has been a good thing as opposed to looking at the Great Depression of the, 30s? We seem to have come through this a little bit better, but we've got a hangover, haven't we? Like, we've got all this potential problem into the future.
Personally, I think it's been a terrible thing. And the reason is that essentially it hasn't worked. I mean, what it's done is increased asset prices, property and share markets. Huge increases in asset prices. That's led to a tremendous increase in inequality.
Yeah.
People who are rich already have got richer, but poor people who haven't got assets haven't really been able to participate.
Yep.
And what's occurred is that because the impact of technology, in particular globalisation over the last few years, has led to downward pressure on incomes, like working people's incomes. So the gap between rich and poor has actually widened, partly because of monetary policy. What the central banks have been doing, reducing interest rates to zero and pumping money into the economy, has lifted the wealth of rich people, but has done nothing for poor people. So I think that really has led to a lot of political populism, which I think is, you know, we've seen manifested in Trump and Brexit, and I think we're seeing it here as well. To some extent.
So your view would have been absolutely let the asset sort of the assets that underpin the world just collapse and take our medicine and then reboot. Was that the?
I suppose I'm not quite at that point. Look, a lot of people say there was a depression in 1921, which is kind of forgotten because it was really sharp.
Yeah.
And it happened fast, and lots of bankruptcies occurred. And because there was a clearing out of the of what happened, it recovered quickly and got forgotten. So maybe, you know, that Schumpeter process of creative destruction would have been good this time. Who knows? It's very difficult to sort of, in a sense, advocate that because, you know, everyone's kind of inclined now, and rightly so, to protect everybody from depression. And it did seem like 2009, beginning of 2009, it looked, you know, it felt like it was going to be terrible.
Yes.
And the last thing you'd want, you mentioned Greece. I mean, really, they had to be kind of bailed out. The last thing you'd want is for the place to go back to the Stone Age. You know, you've got to try and protect them, the people, in some way. And Greece is doing fine, really. I think that, well, not when I say fine, they're kind of...
They're okay. The hidden economy's going beautifully.
That's it. So, look...
destination still?
I think that the central banks of the world have just gone on for too long with monetary stimulus, and should have started to wind back that before.
Yep.
Should have started to increase interest rates before, and should not have worried, as they have been, about inflation so much.
Yep.
I mean, the economy and the labour markets have been quite strong.
Yes.
You know.
In the US especially.
In the US, but also Europe, Australia, everything's, like, most of the data from the economy is okay.
Yep.
The problem only is inflation. And I think everyone's, the central banks have been too worried about inflation being low.
Yep.
Sure, it's true that if you get deflation, so prices are falling across the board quite a lot, then that's terrible because you potentially get into a spiral where people won't spend because they think the prices are going to be lower next month, right?
That's right.
But, and that's terrible. We don't want that. But prices rising at 1 to 1.5% instead of 2% to 3%, who cares?
Mm-hmm. Well, the RBA has a mandate, don't they? I mean, you know, as part of what their job is in terms of monetary policy is to correlate that to a range of inflation.
Well, they've come up with the range. I mean, their mandate is for price stability and for to protect the currency and to try to achieve full employment, right?
Yes.
So they're getting employment, that's fine. The question is, how do you define price stability? They've defined it themselves at 2 to 3%.
Inflation,
And I reckon 1% inflation's pretty stable.
It's okay.
That's okay.
It's okay, yeah, true. So can we just have a quick chat about the Australian economy? What's your view broadly on our economy? I mean, we've got a lot of projects coming online, so our GDP numbers are going to look good till the end of this year. But, you know, that's not the real economy, is it? I mean, what's happening in retail? What's happening in those particular markets? I mean, where do you see this going?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things to point out about Australian economy. One is that there's a difference between the aggregates and the per person numbers. And we're seeing a big divergence that I've never seen before between business confidence and consumer confidence.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is simply that businesses look at aggregates. They're looking at total sales, total GDP, whereas people, individuals, look at themselves.
That's right.
They look at per person numbers.
Yeah.
And there's a big divergence between total GDP and GDP per capita. And in fact, on a real basis, that is to say adjusted for inflation, real incomes per capita have been declining.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore people, you know, individually aren't doing great.
Mm.
So that's one thing. The other thing is the property market, which obviously you guys know all about, is kind of at a very interesting extreme.
Yeah, it is. Totally.
So debt is now very high, obviously, in both aggregate and in individual terms. So that we're at a point where it's becoming a kind of a key risk in the economy, it seems to me. So, and the risk is that you get into a macro spiral whereby, as interest rates rise, people react, in a sense, in a more extreme way than they have in the past to the increase in interest rates by cutting back on their spending, because usually the bank gets paid first and the retailers are the ones that lose out.
Yeah.
And so they cut back spending, which causes more unemployment, more income decline. They cut back spending even more and you get into a spiral that leads to a recession. So I think that the Reserve Bank is in a bit of a bind now as to possibly wanting to put up interest rates in line with the US. However, it's got to really be careful.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, the flow-on effect of retail jobs and general consumer spending is what underpins the economy and the individual in that economy. So if they feel, you know, the wealth effect, if they feel that their wealth, they do tend to basically go into their shell and not spend. We've seen that household savings is not declining, but it's slowing. So we're also seeing a bit of that. And yeah, you know, in terms of debt to income ratios are sitting at all time highs in terms of what they look like. So it is this is the classic case of low cash rate, asset appreciation, because everyone can play. You know, you put the rates down, you give everyone the ability to borrow, and this is that rising tide lifting all ships that we talk about in the property space to sort of say, hey, it looks good everywhere out there, guys, but just be careful because, you know, it's going to not, you know, it's not always going to be this way. And so it's those markets that where usually from my point of view, it's those greenfield new areas where they've gone to 90, 95%. They've got the minimum deposit that they need to. They've gone and bought the house and land package. Then they've gone to, you know, Harvey Norman and got the free 6-month couch package and bed package because they're right on the edge. And then 3 years later, they're going to have a kid and then all of a sudden go down to one income. And so the pressures on those particular locations says to me that's where I see probably an easier way of interpreting risk in those outer suburbs. Because of that particular problem, these people are going to be struggling to maintain their debt levels because they're not great money managers.
Couldn't agree more.
So we've said this before. Winter has come. We're now starting to see the Sydney market slowing. Some of the inner city areas, like we saw some of the auction clearance rates. So I think there was areas like Blacktown and all those types of Bankstown, Blacktown, those types of areas. Auction clearance rates are now down into the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing it already happening in the western suburbs. Now, the inner eastern areas where there's a little bit more wealth base and a little bit more income, they're still clearing at sort of 70s. And that says to me that there's still confidence for those jobs in the sort of finance sector and everything.
Do you have any commentary around the property markets in any of your sort of editorial spaces? Because
some. Not we focus mainly on equities, but... yeah, we have some on property.
I mean, we caught up for dinner with friends of ours last night, the Sydney-based. Was it Manly, one bedroom, no outdoor space, had a double lock-up garage, but for $1.26 million for a one-bedder. There was a two-bedder in Manly for $1.6 million. It's like, you know, even here in Melbourne, you can still get a lot of house for the price that you can get a one-bedroom apartment in Manly for. So... with Melbourne being a destination, a world destination city, with attracting world talent, having to pay world salaries and so many people moving here, there's definitely a potential for there to be two-tier market in terms of particularly Melbourne, where there's still that upside compared to Sydney. Do you have a view on the property market, the two major metropolises of Sydney and Melbourne, and if so, what are they?
I suppose I think that Melbourne and Sydney are separate to the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd throw a rope around Melbourne and Sydney. And I mean, you can see it in the data, obviously, Melbourne and Sydney prices have gone up far more than... In fact, if you look at debt-to-income ratios, in fact, virtually every statistic, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, Hobart, all gone down, Melbourne and Sydney gone up. So then the question is, how sustainable is what's going on in Melbourne and Sydney? And is there a divergence between Melbourne and Sydney going on? And my view is probably not. I'd still rope them together, and I feel like there's likely to be sustained demand in Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's interesting what to think about what you just said about that Manly apartment and the $1.2 million, which is about the broader issue of affordability and how important and how much of an issue is affordability in terms of predicting or thinking about the market. Because property is the only asset, the only investment asset that you also live in. Mm. So the question of affordability of shares or other investment assets doesn't come into it.
No.
The only question is the valuation right? Mm-hmm. You know, is it the correct price? Does it, is the asset worth that much? Mm. And that has to do with the income. But with affordability, it has to do with, well, first-time buyers, can they buy it? You know, can people afford the rent? It's like, it's much more emotional.
Mm. It is.
And so
it's like a bit of artwork in a sense that if someone wants it or two or three people want to fight over it, we might say, why is that bit of artwork worth $1 million, $100 million? We potentially can't comprehend that. But whereas if we're going to, say, commercial property, it's pretty easy. You basically look at the rent that can be achieved and you do a times multiple of that rent to get a valuation.
Exactly.
That's the, that doesn't happen in residential property. It's shelter, but it's an emotional connection that people have. So if we find a great street and a great suburb and there's status and all of those types of things, you know, that's how auctions are so successful, because two or three people just, you know, basically ego takes control of them. What you were saying before about your statement there, it's like, I'm going to win this and I'll push this price further, you know.
Well, it's the only investment market in the world not dominated by investors. So it's, you know, it's like you say, it's an essential need. But
70% owner-occupier.
Do you have a personal view on property? Is it part of your strategy personally?
I own a couple of investment properties. Mm-hmm. They're kind of freestanding houses. I wouldn't invest in an apartment, particularly one off the plan. I might have invested in a kind of an old style apartment in a small block, but I think that freestanding properties within 5 kilometres of the city will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could probably tell me whether I'm right or not.
As I'm sitting here observing some of that the dialogue, and some of our listeners won't know what quantitative easing is. They won't understand how a bond spike will affect the economy. So you started off as a journalist with no real passion for finance, and clearly you've now got a broad view on a lot of financial instruments. How did you accumulate that knowledge? Was it experiential? Did you have some good mentors around you? Was it a combination of both? What did that look like to get to this point?
Oh, reading. Mm. I mean, in my job, you have to understand those things. So I went out and found out about them.
Learned about them. Yep.
So a lot of people think I'm an economist, and I'm actually put on panels with economists who have spent their lives studying, you know, economics, and I'm not. But but look, you can pick it up. It's okay. I mean, you don't have to spend 4 years at university in order to understand economics. It's okay. You can do it.
There's probably plenty of journalists who've read a lot of financial stuff, though, but it still goes over their heads. I'd just say there's a fair level of dedication there that you've got to master the craft.
Yeah. Look, the first 4 years of my working life as a cadet journalist was spent at the Stock Exchange. I mean, I went every day, and in those days, the Stock Exchange was not on screens. It wasn't electronic. It was chalkies. It was an open outcry place you went to, and then up in the thing, there was a gallery of journalists, and we kind of watched and we mixed with the... So, I mean, that was an incredibly good grounding in how capitalism works, really, just to sort of every day understand the sort of the buying and selling, the impact of demand and supply and so on. I mean, you know, I often think that, you know, if in doubt with the economics and there's something you can't understand, it's demand and supply.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
You're giving it away. The secret of the world, demand and supply. With the mentor question, has there been some mentors that have made a real impact on you, and what were their sort of messages to you that you've taken to be the success that you are?
There are some mentors who knew they were mentors and some that didn't, if you know what I mean. Bob Gottliebson was my mentor early on, who hired me to, and that was a kind of a knowing and obvious mentor relationship where he hired me to understudy him and I learnt from him. He basically taught me how to, Bob has always, what he is on about is that business is about people.
Mm.
So when he wrote about business and Chanticleer and that, he wrote about the people involved in it.
Yep.
And that is, I've never lost that. You know, there have been other mentors down the years. I suppose a key mentor that never knew he was, in fact he was dead, is P.G. Wodehouse, who is my favourite writer.
Yep.
an English comedic writer, and he unknowingly taught me how to write.
Okay. You took
and so the way I've approached financial journalism is that it is a writing job, not a financial job, because what you're doing is you're communicating.
Yeah.
Yes, you have to understand the concepts, and you have to, you know, get to know the companies and so on. But really, it's about how you construct your sentences, and are they clear? And are the people going to firstly understand the sentence, and are they going to like that sentence sufficiently to read the next sentence, and then the one after that, and then get to the end of the piece? Yes. That's kind of So for me, it's all about writing.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm a big fan of Bryce, the way in which he can synthesize things down to easily understood things. I can sometimes get lost in the detail and talk in circles, but Bryce is...
Well, I've noticed with interest, that's what Alan says that he does, that he synthesizes things down.
So makes life a lot easier for everyone.
A couple for me to finish off, Ben, if you might have a couple. But given the quantity of reading that you have to do, did you take a speed reading course early days to get through the content? No?
No. I'm not a very quick reader, but I try to, when I'm reading something, try to get to the nub of what it is. There's a lot of writing. Too much padding. There's so much padding. The trick is to find out what's the thing that matters.
Yep.
You know,
my life hacks around a bit of speed reading. Last one is there any books that you'd say to the listeners? For me, How to Win Friends and Influence People was just a must read for me. Is there any books like that for you?
People ask me this, and I can never remember the books I've read. I'm actually in a book club, and we meet once a month and read, you know, both non-fiction and fiction, and. You know, I can never remember what last month's book was.
Well, your book, let's give a plug for your book, which is The Money Book. It was Making Money.
There's a few.
There's about eight or so, I think. Well, 2005, I think you released your Money Book.
Yeah.
So I've got that on the shelf here.
Oh, there you
read that one.
That was good.
Yeah, there you go. So so there's some good frameworks in that, teaching people some fundamentals about valuation principles. You know, there's that great, you know, saying in there that your share of wallet plays with your share of mind. I've used that quite a lot. So there's some good stuff in that. So we'll put
couple of books I'd recommend. One is Guns, Germs and Steel by Jared Diamond.
Okay, yep.
Which is about how come some countries have done well and some countries have not done well.
Okay.
Yeah, what is it, Guns, Germs and Steel?
Steel. Guns, Germs and Steel.
Okay. Very good. We'll put that in the show notes.
Put that in the show notes by Jared Diamond. The other one is The Competitive Advantage of Nations, which is a very similar topic.
Yes.
And apart from the sort of the obvious interest as to why countries, some countries do better than others, you learn a lot about economics from those things, you know, how economics works.
Very true.
So they're good. I mean, I've read a lot of books about Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Value investing.
Tried to understand his approach and his thinking. He hasn't written books himself, but there's been a number of books that have kind of expressed his...
Mm. Have you watched the documentary?
The making of Warren Buffett.
It's terrific.
Terrific.
The access you get to him is quite phenomenal. Yeah. Here's my tip for you. Have you heard of Blinkist?
No.
It's an app that you get on your phone.
And it's like he's on the payroll.
It's like he's on the payroll.
Every week he talks about it.
I did this with my wife this morning. So basically they've got over 2,000 books that they distill down to a 15-minute summary. So Think and Grow Rich, for example, I can hit that while I'm in the car. I can listen to the book summary for 15 minutes. Or while I'm sitting waiting for my pizza to be cooked and I've got 15 minutes. So someone who reads a lot.
What's it called? Blinkist.
Blinkist. Blinkist, as in blink your eyes, ist at the end. Blinkist. I reckon you'll love it. There's plenty of books right
there. In other words, if you go into your book club and you haven't had a chance to read...
Just cheat. Well, at the moment, I use Wikipedia for that.
That's right. I use Wikipedia to do the background on you. So today, Ben, my life hack is really simple.
I don't get any more questions?
Oh, well, usually you put your finger up.
And say, do I?
Have you got another question?
Well, there's one thing. I'm still coming back to the footy because your team's out, my team's still going. But we'll get to
Your team?
GWS is what we picked. So we had a little bet in the finals who would last, and he had Sydney as the grand final winner. And
but you actually barrack for GWS?
No.
Can't you see the false front teeth? Yeah,
he's I'm Collingwood. Yeah, so
who are you?
Because you're the Dons.
Essendon.
Yes. So I've got a couple of quick ones. When you do interview all of these people and you're making an assumption on their business, so you're obviously looking at the business, was there one business that you thought this is never going to work and they've been a real success? Like when you've listened to... Yeah, anyone like that where you're just like, oh, what is he talking about? This thing's never, no one's going to buy this product, and then all of a sudden it becomes a big business or anything like that?
Probably, yeah, maybe a business called Fast Brick Robotics.
Oh, okay, that's the one that's stacking.
Which builds houses, which is a robot that lays bricks. Right?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. You could actually see it.
So it was actually. I started the interview skeptic.
Yeah.
Finished the interview sold on it.
There you go.
But subsequently that's proved to be correct because it's taken off.
Yes, that's a good one. And what about as a journalist? What was the biggest business story you ever broke?
I was never really one of those investigative journalists. Okay. I kind of occasionally stumbled across a story.
Yeah.
And got a yarn, but it wasn't really that.
The Super One's a big story. I mean, at the end of the day, you change mindsets, which then eventually pushed through and we got change. So now most financial planners are fee for service, and you know, there's been a lot of change in terms of regulation.
Yeah, and I do actually take a bit of credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was early on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't just the commissions they were earning, it was also the kickbacks and the soft dollars and the volume bonuses that they're also getting. So all of that is now gone, and we're now starting to see that take shape in the mortgage industry as well.
And it took a long time, and it was the Labor Party, obviously, that changed it with FOFA, Future of Financial Advice, and the coalition came in vowing to repeal that.
Mm.
And I, you know, really worked on the coalition to ensure that they didn't repeal it, and they didn't.
Yeah.
So credit to Josh Frydenberg for that.
Okay, very good. Sorry, mate.
Keep going, but... It was interesting. We for someone who is humble and didn't want to talk about themselves, there's been a lot of terrific content. So, folks, Ben and I are speaking at the Property Buyer Expo in Sydney in October. So if you want a discounted ticket, you can just... it's a free ticket.
Free ticket.
If you put discount code here, Ivis, which is thrown me. If you want a free ticket, just go to the Property Buyer Expo website, type in Property Couch, one word, lowercase, and you'll get a free ticket.
Tickets.
So check that out. Beautiful. And come up and say g'day to us. We'd love to say g'day. And of course, for those people on social media, come and join the conversation at the Property Couch, at Bryce Holdaway, at Ben Kingsley AU. And of course, if anyone's interested in expanding their horizons, Ben, on money and finance and money management, they should check out The Constant Investor. We will have the details in the show notes. So if anyone's interested in reaching out to Alan, saying g'day, that you heard him on the Property Couch, and also asking him some questions about The Constant Investor, all the details.
And it's $1 for the first month.
$1
for the first month, then we go to 25. But you can actually get a good month checking it all out.
For $1. There you go.
Well, what can you buy for $1 these days?
Punch in the Property Couch code and you get it for $1.
There you go.
You don't need the Property Couch code. But it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming on, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly was looking forward to having the opportunity to get your insights, and I know Ben was as well. So I'm sure our listeners got a heap out of that.
Big fan. Well, we've got webinar, just also quickly, on location scores. Webinar's up.
I'm not used to you being all this prep.
I know. Well, Ivis just basically put something in front of me. So check it out. So we'll go to locationscore.com.au and just look for the webinar.
Go on our social media, Ivis.
So, go and check that out as well.
For me, I signed off with a life hack. And the reason I asked about the speed reading is because I like to read a lot of stuff as well. And I'm trying to teach myself to speed read, which I find really frustrating because you have to take two steps back to go three steps forward. So Ben, what I've done is with the, I'm trying to work out, do I want to read a book on the standard, you know, hard copy, mm-hmm. or do I want to read it on my phone?
Yeah.
And so one of the advantages I find on the phone is because it's so small, the principles of speed reading are that you don't read the first two words and you don't read the last two words. You don't let your eye wander because then you can get to the next line quicker because your peripheral vision can take into account those words. So when you're doing that in a book, that's okay, but you've got to move your finger, and there's a bit of a science to it. And what I find is I get distracted by the actual action and forget to take the comprehension, which is why you go two steps back before you go three steps forward.
Yep.
With the iPhone, because it's so, you're actually doing, you know, speed reading principles, because you can actually read the line without actually moving your eyes, and you can take in. So when I was on holiday, I burned through the books.
Did you?
Just for doing, because before that, I prefer to do it on the hard copy. But now I'm sort of, and the added advantage here, I know you want to jump in, the added advantage is that, you know, when you're reading the book and you go, well, that's a big word, I don't know, going to the dictionary, you never get around to it. Yeah. Well, the good thing is with your, you're on the iPhone, right-click the word, look it up, straight away, move on, and you've added to your vocabulary. So I'm now probably 51% on the iPhone, 49%
interesting
on the hardback. Because
for me, it's, so you're saying that it takes a while, because I'd go the two steps back and just don't get the comprehension. So I can try and skim through the words quickly, but I actually have to reread it because it just doesn't drop.
Well, that's the point. It's like you have to learn how to do it. So you got to go back and teach yourself to speed read, and you've got to then measure and speed. And then once you've done it, because Tim Ferriss obviously introduced me to it, he's just pouring through the books.
Yeah.
But I'm that sure process, it's just...
Oh, I was going to say, I don't know whether I've got the intestinal fortitude to... So. I'm just like, if there's a good book and it's being, you know, well received...
So there's the life hack, mate. Do it on your phone.
Do it on your
phone.
It's
like doing speed reading. So, okay. Did you know?
Did you know? Okay, I've got a couple for us, but did you know?
Can I just say...
Oh, yes, Al.
I think slow reading is much better.
Is it? Just don't be patient. I want to get through some more stuff.
The important thing is to pick what you read, only read stuff that's worth reading, and understand it, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's not about volume, it's about quality.
There's a bit of gold right there.
Very wise words for me there.
Bryce brings the quantity, and hopefully we can digest through that.
That's good.
I love them. All right, here we go. Here we go. Did you know 50% of the world population has never made or received a phone call? So we're in this cognitive, technology generation. 50% of the world's population has never made or received a phone call yet.
Wow.
So it sort of puts things into context in terms of some of those other countries where things aren't going so well in terms of their economic prosperity. Here's some others. A quarter of the bones in your body are in your feet.
Ooh.
There's a little interesting one.
Top tip there, yeah.
And the last one, thinking about feet. Did you know that the average person walks around the world 3 times in their average life? So basically, if you live a long life and you're walking around, you're going to walk around the planet 3 times, the equivalent of 3 times. There you go, Bryce. Did you know?
Mate,
finishing off with
the answer
is
I did not know.
Did not know.
Thank you for that. But mate, until next week.
Obviously, remember, knowledge is empowering, but only if you act on it.
There you go, folks. Wise words for the day. But until next week, we'll see you later.